on tap. It is truly a pleasure for me to be here tonight, because in a rather serendipitous moment, I happened to notice a pen lying on the table. It was a black Lamy fountain pen, the Safari model, and I went, wow, that looks like exactly like a pen that I lost at another Theology on Tap a little over a month ago. And I said, if there's red ink in here, particularly a opera red ink, and there was. I lost this in Galloway, two counties over, and it's here tonight. Only the staff and students are understanding why this is such a big deal. Shout out to all my staff and people. Staff, yes. Ministry, awesome. All right. No, the real reason that I am so pumped to be here is to introduce tonight's speaker. I first discovered Eve Tushnet in a blog post about two years ago, and thought, wow, here is a woman with a voice that we need in the church today. Someone who is bringing the experience of being a Catholic, being committed both to the magisterium of the church as well as to who she is as a person. I was thrilled early on when she accepted me as her Facebook friend, because it's all about me. But I'm so, so thrilled that she is here with us tonight at this Theology on Tap for our diocese. A little bit about her. Eve is a writer who lives in Washington, D.C. and attends St. Matthew's Cathedral Parish, of which she is quite proud. Found that out tonight. She was received into the Catholic Church in 1998. Some would say that she wrote the book on being gay and Catholic in America today. It's called Gay and Catholic, Not in America Today, but Accepting My Sexuality, Finding Community, and Living My Faith. We have a book here. I hope that you've read it. I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. The books are on sale. We'll hawk those more later. More recently, Eve has written a novel, Amends, a satire set during the filming of a reality TV show, a reality show about alcohol rehab. She primarily writes arts and book reviews covering everything from pro-life horror movies to the U.S. National Figure Skating Championship. She blogs at Paytheos, which I always pronounce wrong, and apparently so does she. She also writes regularly and has written for Commonweal, USA Today, The American Conservative, The Weekly Standard, and online for The Atlantic, The Washington Post, and The New York Times. Her favorite saint is St. Francis of Assisi, and when pressed for an answer, she really likes the font Times New Roman. Without further strange ado, it is my true joy to introduce your speaker tonight, Eve Tushnet.
Thank you, everyone, for coming out on a kind of windy night. Let me see. I am going to do a three-part thing. It's going to be just a sketch. I'm hoping that people will draw out in questions any of the parts of this that they want more of. The first two parts are a very compressed version of some of what's in my book. So if you want to know if it's something you might be interested in, maybe this will help. The first part will be, how did I get here? How did I become Catholic? Second part will be, what I wish people had told me before I became Catholic. And then the third part will be, what I wish I had known when I wrote the book, things that have been made much more clear to me in that time, in the past couple of years. So I'll just jump right in. I was not raised Catholic. I was raised basically secular Jewish. I had some Jewish religious education, but mostly secular. And I didn't actually encounter Christians who I was willing to listen to, who were willing to share their faith with me until I was in college. I grew up in a very progressive environment, which in many ways, and this is kind of sad, in many ways I was really lucky and perhaps might not have been able to come into the church if I had not been raised in such a progressive environment, because I was able to come to the church without a lot of baggage, without the kind of of shame and fear around my sexual orientation that unfortunately so many Christian children grow up with in this country. I began to realize that I was gay in middle school. I had had before then definitely feelings of being in some important way different from the other kids around me. But there was this, you know, there are a lot of ways to tell a story. One somewhat oversimplified way, one somewhat oversimplified way to tell the story of how I came out to myself was that I borrowed or stole from my sister a detective novel where the narrator was a lesbian. And as she described her feelings for the woman that she had a crush on, I, reading my stolen book, had this sort of lightning bolt moment where I was like, that is exactly what I feel about that girl in my English class. So that was, I took a little while to assimilate it, but I am an extremely impulsive person who has really no concept of sort of caution or consequences or the future as a thing that's real. So I started coming out to other people very, very quickly. I came out to my parents, I think, when I was 13, around then. So that would have been in 1992-ish, 1991, and was involved with gay and queer activism in high school. My best friend, who's also gay, and I started the Gay Straight Alliance at our school. And that was kind of my major, well, that was one of the major things that I did in high school. I came to college expecting that this would be an equally big part of my life there. Then in college, I met a group of people from a debating society with people from a really wide range of different backgrounds. Atheists, Christians of different kinds, mostly Catholic. A guy who was in the slow process of becoming a Hasidic Jew. Really, like, it was sort of extraordinary to see such a broad range of perspectives all being represented at a pretty high intellectual level and with a deep personal commitment to one another. This was the first time that I had met Catholics who were really interested in sitting down with me and saying, here is why I'm Catholic. A lot of them were converts. So here's why I became Catholic, or here's why I've stayed Catholic. Here's what it means to me. And then when I became interested in that, they would move that into, you know, and this is why it's true. This is why you should do it. One of the things that I most appreciate about that experience, well, there are two big things. One was feeling at all times that these were people who did not view me as sort of a notch on their belt, of like, oh, I can make her be Catholic. I think in part because they didn't think that I would. They thought there was absolutely no chance, so, you know, there's no point. We'll just sort of talk to her like a normal person. And then the other thing that really struck me in retrospect was that these were not people who made my sexuality an issue at all. They actually didn't, I don't remember them bringing it up. I think they trusted that if I was interested in what they were saying, I would bring my questions to them. And then they could talk about whatever I was most troubled by or intrigued by in Catholicism. Which is exactly what happened. I began to ask them a lot of questions about various aspects of the church. Everything from the crucifixion, which was like hugely striking, kind of shocking to me, and I was really startled by how persuasive I found it. Is it true that the Catholic Church hates the body? Is it true that the Catholic Church hates sex? And eventually I did get around to asking specifically about homosexuality, because I was starting to feel myself sort of, it was in some ways like coming out to myself, and in some ways like falling in love, that you find yourself drawn, as if against your will, to this astonishingly beautiful woman who you never would have expected to be so compelled by, and who seems to have the potential to reshape your life, except in this case, instead of being the like model chick from my English class, it was the Bride of Christ. So I began to ask, well, what about, you know, is it true that you can't be gay in the church? And I got a varying range of answers that range from beautiful but unpersuasive to totally off the wall and pointless. One, I tell this story a lot, and I'm sorry, because the priest in it is a really great guy. But the priest who ended up doing my RCIA, I had to sit down with him, and I said, I think I was a total coward, and said, some of my friends are gay, and they would like to know, why does the church teach what it does about homosexuality? And he said, well, you know, you have to sort of, you have to think about it this way. Sex between two women would be like trying to open a door when the doorknob is wrapped in barbed wire. Look at him, and I'm like, I mean, first of all, it's not. It wasn't, you know? And second, how do you know? And then I decided I didn't want to think about that anymore. So I came to the point where I was really kind of at a crossroads. I had not received any answers on this particular question, which I knew was really relevant to my life. I had not received any answers on this question that I could personally fully understand or sort of sign my name to. And yet, I was drawn more and more to the church. So I reached the point where I had to decide, well, which thing are you more sure of? This is how I framed it to myself at the time. Are you more sure that gay sex is morally neutral, that it would be okay in all the same circumstances that straight sex would? Or are you more sure that the Catholic Church has authority to teach on ethics, including sexual ethics? That was sort of how I put it to myself at the time, which is a little clinical. But I was startled to find that I was more sure that I could trust the church. Looking back on it now, I think there are other ways of talking about that choice. I think you can say, for example, that, you know, I knew myself to be in deep need of the Eucharist. And if you can trust the church to give you Jesus as the body and blood of Christ in the Eucharist, maybe you can begin to trust that the church can give you Jesus as the way, as a way of life. Similarly, you can say, if you trust the church to be your mother, which I was very definitely on board with, then can you also trust the church to be your teacher and your guide? But again, I was sort of, that's not really an argument, right? It's more a statement of where I was and where I was sort of willing to go. So I started telling people that I was in RCIA and had to explain, that's like catechism class for adults, and had an extremely awkward conversation with my parents, which was actually probably more awkward than coming out to them. And in Easter of 1998, I entered the church and began the long and ongoing process of finding out how kind of naive I had been and how much I had flung myself into this without any sense of what it would mean for my future. When I thought at that time about what it meant to be a gay Catholic, I mostly thought in terms of, well, I should work really hard to understand the theology, and I should not date girls. It turned out to be, you know, okay-ish with the theology, not great to this day. I go back and forth on how well I think I understand it. If you guys want to ask me theological questions in the Q&A, that's fine, but you may find that I fall back on, I don't really know. Or like, here are some possibilities. The not dating girls, again, I was okay at, not great, but, you know, who is? But it was only over time that I started to realize that I was sort of thinking about things the wrong way. That there was one question that I had not asked myself at all that turned out to be the central and most important question of my life, which is, how can I give and receive love? I want to read you something. This is a quote from Andrew Sullivan, a gay Catholic who disagrees with church teaching, who dissents from church teaching, from his book, Love Undetectable. Really beautiful book, beautiful essay. Hold on while I fetch it. Should have found this earlier. Yep. It is still true that in over 30 years of weekly church going, I've never heard a homily that attempted to explain how a gay man should live, or how his sexuality should be expressed. I have heard nothing but a vast and endless and embarrassed silence, an awkward, unexpressed desire for the simple non-existence of such people, for their absence from the moral and physical universe, for a word or a phrase, like objective disorder, that could simply abolish the problem they represented and the diverse humanity they symbolized. The teaching I inherited was a teaching that, in the best of all possible worlds, I simply would not exist. And it was hard to obey this, since it was not an order, it was merely a wish. If articulated, I suppose, the order was abstinence. Abstinence forever, abstinence always. Abstinence not for the sake of something else, but for its own sake. Abstinence not just from sex, but from love, and love's hope and the touch of a lover's embrace. Abstinence even from recognition, acknowledgement, family. So I think he's basically right about what the experience of most gay people in the church is. And that's an accurate description of much of my experience, especially at the beginning, especially in the early years before I kind of made it my business to make priests talk to me about love. And it's extraordinarily difficult to find anyone who will go out of their way to present to people paths of love, ways of pouring yourself out in love for another person, other than the major paths that we're told about, which are marriage and parenting, and sometimes for Catholics, religious life. This is historically unusual. Historically, the church has actually had a much wider range of pathways of love. One of the most central and one of the ones that's been most dear to me and that therefore gets a lot of page time in the book is friendship. Friendship appears in the Bible as a form of devoted love, as a form of love which can make covenants, which can make vows, which can bind people and their families together. We see this in the Old Testament with David and Jonathan and with Ruth and Naomi, who have an extended family relationship that also has many of the characteristics of a friendship. And then we see it in the New Testament with Jesus and the disciples, whom he repeatedly calls friends, and especially in a special way with Jesus and John. When Jesus, this is something that I never thought about for like 10 years, and then suddenly it struck me that when Jesus is looking for a way to express what is like the height of love, he says, "Greater love has no man than this, that he should lay down his life for his friends." And this is like a bizarre statement, I think, in contemporary ears. We would expect him to say, you know, to lay down his life for his children, or to lay down his life for his spouse, maybe to lay down his life for his mother, but he doesn't do that. He doesn't pick up on any of these forms of love that we recognize. He uses friendship as an image of love that is so devoted, so real, and so vibrant, that it can actually lead to the cross, that it can actually lead to self-sacrifice. And throughout much of Christian history, actual existing, you know, random monks and farmers and rebels and kings and knights lived this out to the best of their ability. They had actual social practices that recognized friendship as a form of kinship, something that could give the friends a united household, that could bind them together, lead them to care for one another's children, and essentially bring a person into your family. That has all pretty much disappeared in most places. You can see elements of it and faint hints in the institutions of godparenthood, but the depth and the richness of friendship has largely, I think, been lost in ways that have been harmful both to unmarried people in the U.S., but also to married people who used to have a much wider social network to lean on to support their marriage. There's a whole bunch of other pathways of love and forms of love, ways of having a future that is not barren and alone, outside of marriage. There's intentional community life. I have an interview in the book with a guy, Tim Otto, who has written really beautifully about his life in an intentional community in San Francisco as a celibate gay man. There is pouring yourself out in service to those in need. Forming a family of choice. This is a concept that you'll hear thrown around a lot in the gay community, but I think it actually fits in fairly well with the Catholic understanding of the ability to build, what's what I'm looking for, communities of care, communities that are willing to make sacrifices for one another. And that leads me to the thing that is the most Christian form of love between human beings, which is the church. There really have been times and places in history where your church was actually the haven for love. These were the people who would be your brothers and sisters. It's very rare to find that today. And I do wonder whether part of what the gay movement has done for the church is to recall to us that the church used to be a place where you could be loved, cared for, and sheltered if you did not have a family of your own because you were following Christ. That's all over the New Testament. And it is the experience faced by many gay and lesbian people who find that the world, as it were, offers them gay marriage, offers them parenting, offers them, in some cases, a better relationship with their own parents. Not always. Whereas the Christian church offers them, like, a blank emptiness. The church should be the place where gay people have more opportunities to love and more forms of love than the secular culture recognizes, not fewer. So that's one big part of the book. I think there's a secondary question, there's also a question of what are the goods that my lesbianism is pointing me toward? What are the goods that it flows out of, and what are good ways that I can express those longings? I think there are some that are fairly obvious. There's a longing for same-sex intimacy and devotion, which are normal human needs. There's a longing for solidarity, for essentially community with other women, which I now live out to a certain extent at a crisis pregnancy center where I counsel once a week, which is not the kind of women's community that the 70s lesbian feminists were thinking of, but it turns out to actually be a woman-focused community where we relate to one another on the basis of our common experience of womanhood. There's beauty, recognizing the actual beauty in a woman, which is good, right? This was created by God. There's the desire for kinship and care and covenant, which, again, I think are probably best found for me in friendship. And there's ecstasy, which is intermittent in any life, but I think at its height is found in prayer. Bernini's statue of St. Teresa isn't a statue about sex. It's a statue about the thing that sex is also about, that both sex and prayer kind of manifest, which is love that has become ecstatic. So that's sort of that's the book, basically. What I wish I had known when I wrote the book, one is just that there are other vocations that I didn't talk about. There's a whole bunch. The one that I most wish I had known about is celibate partnership. I now have a couple of friends who are living this out. This is essentially taking elements of monasticism and elements of friendship and marriage and making a kind of two-person monastic grouping that is focused on hospitality, on openness to the outside world, and on a common prayer life. This is not something that's particularly open to me, in part because some of my closest friends aren't Christian, and the focus on the common prayer life is a pretty big part of, I think, a Christian celibate partnership, and partly because I don't really have monastic longings, as far as I can tell. But it's another alternative way of life that I think people are exploring and that offers viable devotion to one another in an extremely mobile world, where it can be hard to know who you can really count on in the long term. And when I mention that these partnerships draw on monastic models, that's been part of how I've learned that one thing I really wish I had thought more about was the relevance of monasticism to the lives of lay people. I think there's still so much work to be done in this area. And I think one of the biggest things that I've been learning as I sort of explore little bits and pieces, the outer edge of monasticism, is that monastic love is the thing that draws people often to the monastery, the opportunity to love. If you guys have ever seen the movie Of Gods and Men, it's the story of a group of Trappist monks, and it's a true story about a group of Trappist monks in Algeria. And when they talk about, when one of them describes what draws him to the monastery, he says that he had experienced romantic love in the world, but he found a greater love. and that was what the monastery was for him. Similarly, I just watched a movie documentary set in a Romanian women's monastery, Romanian Orthodox, where the nuns, when they described what had brought them there, thought it was just sort of obvious. Everyone knew they wanted the opportunity to love. I think it's hard for us to even recognize a love that is by its nature celibate as being the most passionate and the most intense, of which other loves are in some ways symbols or images. And I guess on a practical level, when you look at history, you find that a lot of the viable Catholic communities for lay people exist sort of on the edges of the monastery, in the shadow of the monastery. It's not a bad way to find community today is to look for the religious orders and hang out in their orbit. And similarly, if you look at a lot of the great Christian literature, the Brothers Karamazov, Kristen Lauber's Daughter of Christ had revisited, the great gay Catholic novel, their characters also spend their lives in the shadow of the monastery. And I think that that's unrecognized insight into how lay life works when it's working at its best. And then I think that one big thing I wish I had known is how different my experience has been from the majority experience of gay Christian children. It's much worse out there than I think I realized. I don't think I realized how much American Christian culture has focused on homosexuality as the enemy. And has not only, you know, Andrew Sullivan talks about silence, and that really is bad, that really does kill people, but silence would in some ways be a step up for many kids growing up in our churches who hear about gay people as, in culture war terms, who have to somehow grapple with the knowledge that they are what their church has defined for them as almost like an enemy or a traitor. So I think, and that leads me to the final thing that I wish I had realized, which is just how much I'm asking the churches to change. Not in terms of their theology necessarily, although in some cases, for men, especially for Protestant churches, I can't really tell Protestants what to do, but in terms of church practice, in terms of creating a church that is safe for gay people, in which our sacrifices are supported, recognized, honored, made possible, that actually requires a fairly broad cultural change. I want to close by talking about a movie that I saw the day that the Supreme Court gay marriage decision was handed down. I went with a friend of mine to see Inside Out. I don't know, did any of you guys see Inside Out? In the theaters? So, before Inside Out, there's a little short. There's like a cartoon short, Lava, about this volcano. And this volcano sits in the middle of the ocean, and he's all alone. And all around him, he sees these other animals. He sees two dolphins leaping up together, and two seabirds flying above him together. And he is totally alone and in need of, as he sings, someone to lava. And he's so sad, and no one hears his song. And so eventually, he collapses into the ocean and sinks down to the ocean bottom, and like his fire goes out. But all this time, a lady volcano, a very pretty lady volcano, who seems much younger than him, has been hearing his song, and she finds the strength to rise up from the ocean bottom and I think somehow rescues him with her love, and they sing together. He has finally found someone to lava, and now there is the couple of dolphins and the couple of seabirds and the couple of, like, I don't know what else lives in the ocean, fish, and then the couple of volcanoes. And this actually is basically a translation into a cartoon of Justice Kennedy's decision in the gay marriage decision, where he's saying, the enemy of our time is loneliness, and he's 100% accurate about this, and the solution, the sound, the refuge that we have given people from loneliness is marriage. And again, I think that's accurate. I think that is a 100% accurate portrayal of our cultural moment. You notice that in lava, the dolphins don't have little baby dolphins. The seabirds don't have chicks. There's just the couple. But they have each other forever. And they are no longer alone. There's no community. There's only the couple. And that, I think, is the world that is, in many ways, the ideal that our churches uphold. And it's an ideal that, if your church rejects gay marriage, totally shuts gay people out. If we want gay people to be able to lead a life in the church, we not only have to stop being toxic, we not only have to stop adding to their shame, we also have to offer them someone to love, right? Some form of love that is open to them. So I think with that, I am going to let you guys have some time more to ask questions. I think we're going to take a break, and then I'll be back to answer questions. I know I've thrown a ton of stuff out there, so just sort of write down anything that you're thinking, and I'll elaborate on all of this when we return. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your presentation. You have given us much to think about, and it was, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it was St. Thomas Aquinas said that the purpose of life is indeed to love and to be loved. To love God and to be loved by God and to love others and to be loved by others. That is the most basic meaning that we are all seeking for. On your tables, if I'm not mistaken, we do have an evaluation. Greg, where are you? Where the evaluations are on the table. The evaluations are coming. So before the end of the night, we ask you to fill out the blue evaluation forms that a member of the team will be handing out. We have some other activities coming. Before you leave at some point tonight, pick up a flyer about the Young Adult Retreat at the Marianist Retreat House. When you came in tonight, you received a small white raffle ticket. We'll be calling that in a little while. That's for a copy of Eve's book, Gay and Catholic, Accepting My Sexuality, Finding Community, and Living My Faith. And books are available for purchase if you do not win a copy of the book. Makes great stuff. It's stocking stuffers for...